to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And we are back.
Season four.
I've been waiting to get back here, but I've been enjoying this time off.
Yes.
I needed that.
Yes. Everybody needs a little rest.
Yeah, I took a break from social media at the same time because I didn't have to post the show anymore. And now I'm debating, do I want to come back? Do I want to? I mean, I was on Twitter a little bit and Instagram a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been feeling great.
I mean, I'm sure I would feel good too, but I haven't reached that point of disconnection yet.
Yeah, but we back here in the microphones in your ears.
Yes.
And thank you for having us. Numbers fell off, so let's get those back up because we haven't been posting in like
Come
2 months.
Come back.
So share, like, rate, all of that stuff.
Yes, give us feedback. You guys have been great with the feedback. We appreciate it.
Bonita has been loving us on social media.
I love that
people are checking us out, and the break was actually long enough for people to go back and because every week it depends on a lot, you know, it's a lot of stuff to catch up on,
right?
And so having that break allow people to go back and catch up
and listen to some old episodes. I even went back and listened to a few things.
Oh, yeah?
I went back, I listened to witchcraft.
Okay.
And I listened to the purpose of prayer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, came up in a conversation. I was like, you know what? Let me go back and listen to this.
I hope we did it right.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we left a lot of open doors.
Okay.
There are a lot of things we can revisit.
All right. Also, shout out to our newest Patreon, Doug Rice, ADH Doug on Twitter.
Yeah, thanks, Doug.
Thank you so much. This production is brought to you by Doug.
Come on, sponsors. I appreciate you.
All right, so we are back, and today, as the title and show notes suggest, we are talking about the importance of myth.
Yes.
All right, so season four has been, or will be, our season for building up our faith.
And yes, seeing, rebuilding.
Rebuilding. We've not torn down, but we've deconstructed a lot.
A lot.
We've looked at some traditions and some history. And
mm-hmm.
Now we're going to see, now that we've shattered all of the previous things that we learned.
Uh-huh.
What do we do moving forward? All right, so we got to start at the beginning at myths.
Okay.
During the break, I've been reading a lot of creation stories.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I went to Alaska and I saw a guy who was part of the Tlingit tribe. And
okay.
He was telling me about one of their creation stories. And it's about the raven and the eagle and the way that they organize in the tribes based on those two animals and how they greet each other and what it means to be like a raven never mates or partners with a raven.
Okay.
And so they mix and there's a whole mythology around why they do that, and I just was so fascinated with,
yeah,
and so I just got into the books and started reading
mm-hmm.
tons of creation myths
mm-hmm.
from different cultures around the world. So I guess we could start with one of the most famous creation myths. But first, just talking about myths, I do want to challenge the perception that myths are false.
Mm.
That's not the purpose of a myth.
Okay. And
especially in antiquity, myths are not intended to be a scientific expression of
right.
something that happened. Myths are intended to explain
mm-hmm.
observed realities,
yep.
how they got there. Myths are transmitted orally over time,
mm-hmm.
and we'll talk a little bit about that later.
It gives
in the show.
It gives a common narrative,
right? And people can believe a myth without challenging its veracity. You would innately know this may or may not be the way it happened. This is the way we understand it.
Mm-hmm.
Something that we can't. So, for instance, science has a myth
mm-hmm.
Called the Big Bang. There's nothing proven about it. It's just that this is what we suspect happened
right.
at the beginning.
Right.
And people are fine believing that, whether they know this is accurate or not. I mean, they'll try to prove it.
Yeah.
But if that happens to not be the case, if it was something else, I think people would be fine with that. But
right.
for now, that's the present explanation. That's the present mythology in the scientific community.
Mm-hmm.
religious myths and cultural myths work the same way.
Yes, they do.
They kind of act as cultural dreams to point us to different things. And in some ways, they shape our lives.
Right. So let's talk about whole systems that are built around myths, just to kind of make to illustrate the point a little bit more. So people are familiar with the terms, you know, Egyptian mythology, Greek mythology, Roman mythology, mm-hmm. just for reference. And where those God-like characters and their characteristics, their physical and mental and emotional characteristics, their attributes and what they were responsible for in that human's day-to-day life is how we kind of, it helped, like we said, explain happenings that maybe we had not yet developed a scientific way mm-hmm. to describe certain happenings, or we had not yet, there was no written record to cause association between, you know, item A or person A and the happening. Mm-hmm. So especially in Egyptian mythology, you had this build out of its own pantheon where these god characters were responsible for things like the harvest, the Nile rising mm-hmm. and falling, famine, life, death, fertility, things of this nature where they are happening. They have been observed, mm-hmm. but it gives you a common narrative to say this god rules over this faction mm-hmm. of what happens in our life. So what happened in Greece and in what became Italy, but happened in Rome, is that you had this same association of godlike characters who are responsible for certain happenings in a human's life. And by giving that collective narrative, you also have a build out of the foundation of a belief. What does that belief lead to? It leads to whether or not this deity is to be worshipped or be feared, or mm-hmm. how it's supposed to be interacted with.
And that's where we'll get a little bit more into mm-hmm. that, but that's where we start to see some of the potential issues with mythologies. But at their core, myths are our stories mm-hmm. that we tell ourselves about us.
Yep.
They will have other characters. They may have gods. They may have special creatures. But at the heart of every myth is a story that is about us.
Mm-hmm.
So different cultures have their different myths. And what's interesting is none of them are created in a vacuum. They all exist within a culture,
yep.
which is abutted by other cultures.
Yep.
And so the influence is always there. So, for instance, if we were to have a creation myth now that we came up with now,
mm-hmm.
it would be very difficult not to include some science in what we think. So Big Bang may be a part of it or some form of that, because that's a common understanding of what's going on now. So in the Bible, we see that a mm-hmm. lot. Now, growing up in the barbershop, mm-hmm. Dudes would come in there and talk about, like, why would you believe that? They just copied that story from Babylon or the mm-hmm. Gilgamesh epic, Enuma Elish, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they really wouldn't be persuasive in the argument, because you could tell they just kind of heard this somewhere.
Yeah, they're parroting.
Yeah, uh-huh. But it doesn't mean that they don't have a point. They do have a point.
Right.
In the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish the Christians will call it the Old Testament.
Yeah.
But in the Hebrew Bible, there was a period where the Israelite people, the Hebrews, were enslaved.
Yes.
They were enslaved in Babylon. And then there was a period when they went in exile. So when they're in these situations for hundreds of years, they're hearing other myths and other creation stories. And so what happened is they came out of the period of exile and decided to establish their own.
Mm-hmm.
But their own looks like some of the other
stuff.
What
they had heard. Mm-hmm.
With variations that are applicable to them.
Because they center themselves.
It's stories about ourselves.
Yes, it's stories about ourselves. But so, we had gone over this before too,
mm-hmm.
just as far as when you are denied access to literacy, it doesn't go as far as a creation myth, but when a theology is able to be expanded to center a previously marginalized person, it creates a new narrative to explain the existence of that person, that community, that experience, because now I'm telling it from a different perspective.
Right. And so you see some of these similarities in just the nature of creation. There's a snake. That's not the only tradition that has a snake. There's a flood, many, many creation myths. I'm sitting here reading an encyclopedia of creation myths.
Okay.
Many have floods in their stories because that's a way, water is so important and it's a way of cleansing. Mm-hmm. It provides life.
Yeah.
And for instance, you wouldn't have a city that was not near water. That city could not survive. So water is so vital to life. So a flood was part of it. You had sometimes dual natures. You had a positive and a negative opposing forces. You have some type of disruption. But in particularly the Hebrew creation story in Genesis 1 and then the second story in Genesis 2, there's this idea that the world, and this is the science part of it, the world is structured a certain way. So the earth is the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. There was this idea that there's water under the ground and there's water above the sky. And the sky separates the two. That was in the Babylonian epic. That was in the Epic of Gilgamesh. Mm-hmm. And so these elements you'll see, not because they're borrowing, but because this is just the common understanding of the world.
Right.
Or the universe at the time. And so, yeah.
And the narrative spread through that same thing that we talked about in conquering. Mm. You know, I give you, if some of the ways that we said that culture and religion spread is that I take the story that you're telling and I superimpose a new narrative on top of it. Mm-hmm. So because I don't necessarily want you to reject my new message because it's so foreign from your own. If anything, I'm going to build bridges from what you're saying to what I want you to say. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, especially in a conquered land, I'm going to build these bridges to this new narrative that explains my presence and my position over you. And it becomes our common story.
Right. It's interesting. Like I sit in classes and see people's worlds rocked when they're told these things are myths, and all of their presuppositions about myths are brought to that conversation. Mm-hmm. And then it's difficult for them to process. But I don't have any problem understanding this as a myth because there's a point to it. There's mm-hmm. there's something that they're trying to do. They're trying to, again, tell stories about themselves. They're also trying to tell stories about their God, because these are the things that separate our God from this other God.
Exactly.
Our God doesn't hate us. Our God did not kill another God in order to bring us into existence. Our gods don't have sex with each other. Our gods don't do those things. This is the God of this people, and these are the reasons why we live this way.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to explain the reason for childbirth, for instance. They're trying to explain agricultural difficulties. They're trying to explain, in some cases, their societal structures and why women and men are positioned differently.
Mm-hmm.
They could be trying to explain why they were in exile, why people behave a certain way, represented by the knowledge, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and things like that. So the myths are trying to explain their observed realities. Mm-hmm. And this is the news for them. This is how they know, hey, you know, this is why those crops don't come up. You know,
exactly.
This was the curse.
Yep.
And so these things help them live. It helps them understand the world that they're living in.
Mm-hmm. Rationalize.
Right. For good or bad. This is important because in the absence of this, what is the alternative? The alternative for them would be the myths that they heard from other people. Maybe older myths, maybe different types of things that they don't really align themselves with.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, that would be like Black people adopting the religion of their slave masters.
My goodness.
Just outright, no changes. Just take the all the verses about slaves in the Bible and Jefferson's special Bible, and that becomes your Bible.
It's a lot. Y'all should have known we was gonna do that, but okay. Welcome to Faith Uncut.
Yeah, we back. All right, so they're establishing their God amongst other gods. They're acknowledging Yahweh as a creator.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and then they're telling a story about how we came to be in the story. What's our part in the story? So in the first creation story in Genesis 1, you have a God this God has a plan. This God says things and they happen. Or this God says things and does things or creates. And after every stage, that God says it's good. And so the God says it's very good, talking about all of it.
He slices.
And then that God takes a break. End scene. That's the end of that creation story. Then we pick up in Genesis 2 with a different story. And this God is almost like a different God. Because this is written by a different author. And so this God, as opposed to having a plan and not needing any help, this God seems to be figuring things out as it goes along. So the God gives rules. Mm-hmm. With no idea that these rules are now going to be followed or it's going to be broken and ushering in all of this destruction. This God tries to create a partner for the Adam, the human, mm-hmm. and doesn't figure it out until, you know, tries to do all these things. And then it says, you know, and then God saw that it wasn't suitable for the man to be alone. Like, this God didn't know that. This is not the same God in the first story that just created everything that had all of the stuff. So it's really interesting to see how different people see different things. And in between the two stories, you get a rounded picture of...
I was about to say, is that not a facet?
Yeah. So the belief is that they complement each other. Mm-hmm. Definitely two distinct stories written right. Two different ways. In the first one, the God is Yahweh, and the second one, the God is Elohim. But the focus is different. The God in the first one is otherworldly. This God sits outside of everything mm-hmm. and just speaks and does things. the God in the second story is described in anthropomorphic terms. This God walks in the garden. This mm-hmm. God doesn't know. Where is asking questions. This God mm-hmm. is forming with the hands, you know, the humans. This is a different type of God.
Right. Still a creator.
Still a creator. Mm-hmm. But that creator is not like super powerful and speaking and it is so. This God
He's
is hands-on.
Detail oriented.
Right. This God is intimate with the creation.
He is a fashioner. Mm-hmm.
So this is an amazing... Why are we talking about this? This is an amazing view of things for people who have left exile. This God says, I know you. I formed you. Mm. I care about you. This is the affirmation that you need after experiences like that.
Right.
And so you can kind of see why this would be the story, because people need to know, like, just like Black people in America, like, when is God going to step up and do something?
Mm-hmm.
A story like this says, this God cares about you. And they were out of exile when they wrote this. So it's like, look, you're free now.
Right.
Let me tell you about Yahweh.
This is a reflection.
It's an amazing thing. These creation myths or these stories are so affirming. But then there's another side to it. Social hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
For a long time, I kind of looked at the story of the creation of the male and the female, or the Adam and Eve, and saw that the Eve was in the subordinate position. That's because that's what I was taught.
Yeah.
I was taught that the Eve was created second. The Eve was created out of man, which is completely opposite of the biological workings of the world that we know.
Uh-huh.
The woman creates. The woman births. And so this was a way, I was taught that this was a way of also including the man in that process. Like, yeah, you create, but we did it first. Or you came from us. So the more we're studying the text, the more I'm learning that that's not the case.
Yeah.
The more women get their hands on the text, the more we have alternative views that are richer and provide so much more context.
Yeah.
So, for instance, these are stories, and every story has a hero.
Mm.
Now, what's unique about the hero is usually the hero starts off learning a lesson. Mm-hmm. With a failure.
I was going to say, not a hero at
right,
all.
They're not a hero because there has to be
flawed.
A progression. Yes.
Yes.
All right. So in the second creation story in Genesis 2:3, we see that, okay, the man and the woman are created together, same day, same substance, all of that stuff, equal. The Bible, the Hebrew Bible says that the snake, this talking animal, which is, there's no such thing as a talking snake. It's part of the story. It's part of the myth. The snake was more clever than every other animal. And that's not clever in a bad way or crafty. It's not crafty in a bad way. It's crafty in a good thing. Mm-hmm. In a good way. God said these things were good in the first story. But nothing that God made was not good. Furthermore, the snake doesn't lie at all in the story. So what you have is this intelligent animal that is looking for a conversation partner. That crafty animal, that intelligent animal, picks out the woman, mm-hmm. and they have a conversation.
Wait.
What's wrong?
Nothing.
So now what happens is the woman now is looking for something. The woman is being active about pursuing this knowledge that is said to be off limits. And then so you ask yourself, why doesn't God want them to know things? What is so bad about it? And then we see later in the story what happens. But you see the woman chases knowledge.
Yes.
Based on information or a conversation that she had with the snake that was not a bad conversation. The snake was asked her a question. She came back and responded. The snake said, surely you will not die. They didn't die when they ate the thing.
Everything changed.
You will become like God. Your eyes will be open. That's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. So the woman is active the entire time, makes a choice to eat of this fruit, then gives it to the man who was there with her the entire time. The scripture says that the man was right there, but the man is passive in the story, almost like a sidekick in this story. Mm-hmm. She eats, gives it to the man. He eats. No questions, no inquiry, no
resistance.
I remember when the God told me, you know, I shouldn't do this. Mm-hmm. The man didn't do anything. The man's just there.
With his boo, eating an apple.
So this fits the narrative of a hero's journey. Mm-hmm. Then you start to, if we expand that out and we start to see the journey.
The conflict that comes.
So there's so many different ways to see how this moves and how this story progresses. And I don't see the woman as the unknowing partner. Mm-hmm. The woman was the most active, most intelligent person in the whole exchange. The woman made a choice and wanted it was a good choice. She wanted knowledge. And so that began her hero's journey. Mm. And so, again, there's many ways to see these
stories. This is important, though. Like, see what I'm saying about open doors? Because I feel like culturally, that particular story keeps happening over and over again. In her quest for something that is not necessarily bad, mm-hmm. illegal, unfit, a detriment, there is a cost for her reaching out for either that knowledge or mm-hmm. that level or that acceptance, you know, that belonging in this, you know, informed group. Like you said, and I'm just sitting here, y'all know I just be like, Mike is so smart. But
no, I'm not so smart. I'm just learning.
I know, but you're teaching too. Okay. So imagine when we talk about myths, I'm sitting here feeling like, oh, okay, there is something to be said. There's a positive attribute for the display of the thirst for knowledge, because that is a whole different casting of that particular story. She went on a quest for knowledge. Mm-hmm. That quest had unseen twists and turns because it caused for them to say, are you going to behave in, you know, way in this one option A, mm-hmm. as you've been told, or in this other option B, as you exercise your reason and think through whether or not it is worth it to depart from what you've been told. Most people's faith story has that question in it. Mm. Are you going to do what you've been told to do? Or are you going to do what you've arrived at the conclusion is the best thing to do? These things are not always the same. Consequences abound on both sides. Mm-hmm. How we use language to express what those happenings are ultimately affect whether or not we see it as positive or negative. Even if it, you know, you make a choice and it might take you off your path. You did not realize there would be so many ramps off your path, so many rest stops, so many I don't know, little pits of quicksand. So many, you didn't expect to show up in this landscape. You didn't expect to have this career. You didn't expect to live in this place, but you made a choice that led you toward a different set of options and possible outcomes. If you don't do that, where does the richness of your experience come from?
Right.
It's completely different. That's a completely different casting of this often told story of how women, I don't want to make it seem stereotypical, but it's like, you say we're the reason, you know, that the fall of man, you know, goes directly through women. And we've talked about the behavior that that elicits, not just from men of faith and men who are not of faith, but also of the church toward women. I like how we just told it.
Yeah, there's so many ways to see that. So one valid way is to view the woman as the protagonist, the woman who learns and begins her journey of growth. The woman ends up being the person who brings culture. They end up being removed from the garden. And so now they spread out into the world. The woman starts to do what some women do and have children and start to populate the earth. And then you have all of these people coming and all these people learning. And then she starts to learn. And then it becomes this beautiful hero story. One possible view of it. And these are the power of these creation myths.
Right.
You could see it a different way, but this is another way that a lot of people may not have considered that.
Yeah.
This was just the start of a hero's journey. And instead of being the passive sidekick, the woman was the active participant who made a choice, saw the results of the choice, and began the journey towards restoration.
I like it.
So creation stories are so powerful in terms of what we can learn from them. I want people to be fair in terms of assessing what's possible from a myth like this or any other tradition's myth. People act like they can't learn, or like they don't learn from movies. Like they act like they can't go to a movie. Like people learn from like Toy Story and The Incredibles
and
Finding Nemo and X-Men. Yeah. And all this. There's so much stuff to learn. Why do we have an aversion to learning something from this story, which is so rich with information and so ancient in a way that it's fed so many people?
Right. It persists.
I just want you to be fair in terms of learning. I mean, understanding that you can learn from these things like you learn from other from other traditions. Okay, so as we're learning, it's important to be able to recognize myths. We said at the beginning of the show that myths are the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. There are many modern day myths that we tell. So for instance, I'm pretty sure at most Thanksgiving, we tell myths about ourselves, about our family members, those who are here and no longer here, those stories about different events that occur, why this person is considered, you know, the person that you don't mess with in the family, why this person is the person that you call when you need help,
right?
You know, what they've done and things like that. A lot of times they're embellished, but these are the versions of modern day myths that we tell ourselves. These are oral traditions that are passed down.
And it's important that they be told. It's important that they be told.
We come from a rich tradition of storytellers.
Yeah.
And it's important to keep that tradition alive. And we do this. We do this, you know, in our salons, in our barbershops. Yeah. We do this online. We do this.
That is a strong cultural tradition, though, you know. And without the telling of these myths, we don't have a body of knowledge within which to kind of mine for these truths. So keep in mind, you know, when we talk about a creation myth, we're not talking about in a society where everybody can read and can write and can document for themselves, you know, their own story. So much like what we see in our own community and in older communities, I don't want to say that we're an ancient, you know, people, but you have to think that the persistent telling of stories is actually the first bridge back. When people say, I'm looking for roots, I'm looking for where do I come from? This is bigger than a point on a map. You want to know the type of people you come from. So I think I told a story last season about realizing that my forebears were Pentecostal preacher, mm-hmm. and feeling at once, I don't know, like I was fascinated by it, but I was also like, that explains it. That explains some of the richness that I've even seen in my family when it comes to the interaction with not only church as institution, but church as resting place, church as celebration point, church as mediator. Certain things made sense, realizing that, you know, somewhere along the lines at our root, we were involved with that reflection of community, that institution, that building in a different way. Mm-hmm. I always talk about being in the audience. I come from people who ran it. It added another facet to my understanding. Yeah. But someone had to verbally tell that story, and then connect, let's say, my grandmother at age 90 at the time with his grandmother in her mid-80s, come to find out they are cousins coming from the same set of siblings from, let's say, 1860 to 1880.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah.
You see what I mean? But the family cemetery is what it is.
Right.
So on both sides of that family, as they consider the people who are laying in rest there, they had a side of the story and we did too. So in telling that oral tradition, you say, why do people need this? We have talked about what it takes to create community. Mm-hmm. We have talked about, you know, coming to agreement about the story. What are we going to decide that our truth really is, whether or not it can be scientifically proved? That's not the standard that we hold it to. Mm-hmm. We hold it to the standard of, does it make sense to us? Does it, like you say, does it explain our observed reality?
Mm-hmm.
So this is where, if you allow yourself to think about it, your family, your associations, the groups that you have an affinity toward, they all have some sort of story about why it was necessary to unite, link up, you know, form a coalition, be together. Even a couple, I fell in love, I saw you, I did this, I did that, my family had this, your family had that, we joined together, we had more together.
Mm-hmm.
These stories add to the richness of the rooting.
And the more we tell these stories, the better the stories become. Whether these are embellishments on stories about real people or mm-hmm. creative takes on existing stories. One example that I think of is C.S. Lewis mm-hmm. wrote The Chronicles of Narnia, which The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is one of the most famous book from that series.
Mm-hmm.
The Chronicles of Narnia is basically a Christian allegory, and it starts with creation, and there's a Christ figure, which is the lion Aslan, who eventually, I'm gonna spoil it, eventually dies and is resurrected.
Mm-hmm.
There's the children who represent the humanity. Then there's the struggle against the evil. And it's a beautiful story. Even the last battle is supposed to depict Revelation and the events there. C.S. Lewis did this, and he's telling a story, and he meets a guy in 1926 named J.R.R. Tolkien
mm-hmm.
at Oxford. They are part of this Oxford literary group called the Inklings, and they tell each other stories. And so Tolkien told Lewis his creation or his mythology,
yeah.
and where Lewis created a world called Narnia as an allegory, Tolkien created a world called Middle Earth. Same type of religious imagery there. Mm-hmm. There's a golden idol of this ring that people yeah. want and they chase. Then there's this duality between Gandalf and Sauron, these two things that are always butting up against each other. There's the Shire, which represents the garden, because the hobbits have to leave the garden mm-hmm. and go out to the world. So Tolkien was dealing with all of this religious imagery, and Lewis was like, you need to put this out and this needs to be read by people. And so he talked Tolkien into publishing The Lord of the Rings. Thank God
that yes, we have The Lord of the Rings.
and these type of myths are so important. Immediately when I read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, The Chronicles of Narnia, I knew that was a Christian
mm-hmm,
allegory.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien was different. I had to sit with that one. And then I was like, wait a minute. I see what he's doing. I see the dots that he's connecting here. This is incredible. And then I started to read about it. I was like, oh, he did this intentionally. These myths that we tell each other, these myths that we create, the way we riff on them, these stories matter so much. I mean, they move culture. And no matter what type of information you need to convey, the best format is going to be the story every time. I could sit here and read y'all a theological book and y'all would cancel this podcast immediately.
You're like, I'm tired.
But if we tell you a story, if we have the conversation, you're more inclined to actually listen. Then you're more inclined to tell the story to someone else. No one's telling a boring story, so the stories have to be good, and that's how they grow and things like that. But you have to tell a compelling story. Then someone else has to be compelled by the story to share it. And so this is how we enhance our experience as human beings. I mean, there's, you got the Avengers, you got in Black Panther, you had the Wakandan creation story where they told it to have the movie.
Bast.
And the vibranium.
Where it came from.
And all of that stuff is important. I mean, we have, Star Wars, you got Wonder Woman, all of these origin stories, all these things that
where they take the time to tell you.
Right. And so when I'm watching them, I'm realizing they're not just about, that story is not just about Wonder Woman. That story is about us. That story is about how who we are, who we've been, and how we've changed and things like that. Like, there's dystopian stories like The Handmaid's Tale where they take basically a Christian idea, run it to the extreme. We talked about this on the show. And it's a future telling of a creation myth or origin story. So at some point, we haven't gotten that part of the story yet. Some of it we've gotten. There were these events that led to the dystopian future that they're living in, and the telling, the retelling of that, or the forecasting of that, is a different type of myth, but it's also powerful because it's a warning as to what you don't want to do.
So one example that just came to my mind was from one of my favorite movies, which is Apocalypto, where Apocalypto, which was produced by Mel Gibson.
Was that a Mel Gibson movie?
It was.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
It was, because it was right around time he was tripping. But in Apocalypto, as they are living their day-to-day life in their own understanding that they're, you know, within the jungle, there are smaller tribes and larger, more powerful tribes that feed into Mesoamerican empires. So I believe that the overall, they were to, I think they were Aztecs, but they... The display of the movie was showing how these smaller tribes had to fend for themselves or could not repel these armies coming out of this larger society. And it was just a snapshot. The movie is so rich and so moving, but it was literally, I think, not even a week's time that they were documenting the difference between the smaller village being invaded. And in showing how the smaller village interacted with this larger empire through conquest, it actually foretold the conquest that was coming for the larger empire. And the warnings throughout the movie were these, what do we call them? Like the girl who was talking about the jaguar. Remember? And she was like, I can't remember her exact words, but she said, you've kidnapped the wrong person. And it's going to basically rain hell on your whole society, like an oracle. So she had given this warning, but it was a myth that the smaller village, as well as this larger empire, had in common, that if you violate this particular principle amongst the people, you're going to pay for that. And the first way that they thought they would pay in tangible ways, they said, oh, it'll be a life for a life. Right. So. I just remember when that army officer, when that army officer lost his son, he immediately processed it like, well, that girl told me that for me stealing these villagers and kidnapping these people for human sacrifice, I'm going to pay a sacrifice. That's what he thought it was going to be. What it really was that last scene where they looked out and there were three European ships, three Spanish ships coming into their harbor. It's like, this is something that you can't even imagine. And the first time I saw it, my jaw dropped, because I was like, that is perfect. oh my God, because you see ships, but I, as a history student, somebody who's read what happened after those ships arrived, everything from the beginning, you know, right up to that scene made so much sense, because I was like, you thought it was business as usual. You thought this was just going to be a regular raid. And we was going to bring these people to this temple. We was going to shed a little blood because we wanted a good harvest, and we knew an eclipse was coming. So there was this interjection of understood science up to the time. Mm-hmm. But there was also a lot of myth. If we don't do this, our outcomes will be worse than if we do.
Right.
I don't think anything's worse than what happened after those people docked their ships.
Mm. So now I'm going to go back and watch Apocalypto. Yo, so we have to wrap
this
podcast.
That is my favorite movie.
So this is, we're talking about this at the beginning, is because the beginning is important. Mm-hmm. And it should not alarm or harm you to know that these are creation myths, because the story that they're telling, we've gotten away from the Bible as a science textbook. It's not that.
Nope.
What these stories are trying to tell you is we don't know what happened, but we want you to consider what God has done. The thing we know is that we didn't do this.
Uh-huh.
So let me tell you a story about how this happened. Why this happened. Why these things that you're uh-huh. experiencing are the way they are. And I'll even give you a bonus story. Uh-huh. We tell you one story in Genesis 1. We tell you a second story in Genesis 2. Different people have different ways of seeing this. And that is okay. Your way of seeing it, according to the Hebrew Bible, may be different than someone who is Hindu and their many ways of seeing it, mm-hmm. or someone who is Baha'i, or even someone who is just completely scientific.
Right.
And that's okay.
These are cultural. These are not necessarily religious stories.
They're for us. If it helps you, let it help you. If it doesn't, then do something else.
Right.
But that's what we wanted to put on your mind to start this season. We're gonna start seeing what we can construct, and we got to start at the beginning. So next week we have a very special guest coming to the show. It's a familiar voice. We hope you tune in for Faith Uncut. I'm your host, Mike,
and I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.